Thanks for listening to the Replatform podcast, sponsored by Crown Peak and Elastic Path, and hosted by me, James Gurnall Rogers. We bring interviews of industry thought leaders, the C-suite of tech companies and leading retailers, showcase you what they're up to, how they're using tech, hopefully help you make better business decisions. All we ask in return is you tell other people about the podcast, like and share our posts on social media. And if this is your first time listening, give us a rating. It really helps with our visibility. So today's episode's an interesting one. So Paul and I have been speaking to recently and over the last few years to some large organizations around like technology selection and replatforming. And inevitably at that level of change, there is more risk and it's more complex. And I think sometimes there can be some reticence to look at a replatforming and to consider it and maybe push it down the line. So we wanted to talk about some of the areas around project management, how large businesses can tackle replatforming, how you make better decisions. And it also leads nicely off the back of a post that was on LinkedIn recently by Rick Watson, where I think the title was like, most enterprise CEOs rather gnaw off their arm than replatform. So we want to look at why sometimes it's more challenging and more risky, but actually how you can make sensible decisions and help the business make good technology decisions at this level. So let's kick off with, I guess the foundational question is, what are the unique challenges and risks for large organizations or organizations where we're not just talking about large on revenue, we're talking about in terms of business size, systems complexity?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I think the first point that always comes up is like the definition of enterprise. I personally probably see it more around like size of business and, you know, number of people, that whole piece. And I guess that, like, particularly the people point is probably one of the biggest variables, just where you've got more teams, you know, more major stakeholders, you know, and there's like bigger impacts and you need to get more people bought in. And I think in my experience, you've got that piece and then you've got the tech side, and a lot of the larger, more enterprise businesses we work with will have more kind of, yeah, legacy technology, more technical debt. You know, more systems that cannot be touched or cannot be changed. So anything you are putting in place, you know, you have to kind of fit in with those systems, or, you know, you've got kind of a relatively rigid way of working. But I think they're my big two, I guess, like, you know, having more stakeholders, potentially having, you know, really big in-house development teams, like, yeah, just more variables around people and then the tech side. But what would you add to that?
Yeah, the tech debt, definitely. I think, and the fact that tech's picked in silos is often the problem, isn't it? Because then the tech isn't designed to integrate and work well together. So you have a lot of manual workarounds and like hard code. I've seen it's things where hard coded stuff's been created to enable bits of data to transfer from one system to the other. And obviously that means if you pull out one system, that's going to break that connection. Then it's the process debt that I think is a bit that's least talked about at enterprise. So this is where you have teams that have grown over time and different parts of the business who've grown out without being integrated from a process point of view. So product buy-in and orchestration is a great one, where you might have the buy-in team that's using a particular bit of technology or using range of spreadsheets to do all of the product planning, the range assortments, etc. Then you've got a merchandising team whose job it is to take the products and enrich the data and get it all ready for web. They're using a different system and they've got a different process and different spreadsheets. And then you've got an e-commerce team that's basically running and managing the website in another set of technology. And there's lots of reliance on emails and manual processes. That in its own, the process bit, when you start looking at it from a true BA point of view of mapping it out, is what terrifies most people, because they realize how much effort is involved to re-engineer a process to be more automated and to be aligned with new tech. And the impact that then has on people, because you talked about resistance change. You have some people who will always be resistant to change. This is how I do it. Bringing those people online with a project where there's better automation and maybe something they themselves have created and have real pride and ownership in is no longer required. That creates friction. So I think the process bit often creates some of the bigger problems.
Yeah, so I guess this is that just reminded me of something that I've seen a bit more like coming downstream a bit recently that I think can work really well. So you see these larger businesses like build out kind of large transformation projects, I guess, or different phases, addressing different parts of the business. And I guess one of the benefits of doing that is that it's going to make it easier to kind of like join up thinking and like influence change across different teams. But yeah, I felt that's quite an, that I didn't know. I think we had Josh on once from Jigsaw, but he, like, that's an example of a business which I've put in like the kind of medium sized category, but like they have like full time headcount in transformation roles. And they've made some really positive change in their business. And I think, yeah, that just reminded me of that. It's a bit of a tangent, but I guess that's one consideration when you are trying to make big change in the businesses, is kind of how you structure the projects and how you actually work cross team.
Crown Peak, enabling organizations to build meaningful digital experiences for everyone, everywhere. Engage your customers with our content management system. Reach your entire audience with our digital accessibility and quality tools, and grow your brand with our product discovery solution. Find out more at crownpeak.com.
Definitely. Do you know what's interesting? I worked with House of Fraser a few years back, and they were going through a massive replatforming. And what they did smartly is they brought in a change management, an experienced change manager. So they had their PMO team with BAs and project managers doing the, so they built out, because they realized that they couldn't do it without a proper function, because the existing team didn't have the resource or didn't have the skills, basically. And I think this is often where big businesses go wrong, is it's trying to get existing teams alongside maybe a technology agency. You need program and project management expertise at this level, because it is a specific discipline.
Yeah.
Change management is different. Not all PMs are good at change management, because change management has a really strong human element in terms of understanding the impact on people's roles and how you plan for that. But the one skill that I haven't seen, and maybe it's just because the businesses I've worked with haven't gone down this route, is product management. So often what I find is you can have really good project discipline, but there isn't enough focus from the product ownership of what the technology is and doing and what the priorities are, because each part of the business has owned its part of it. So the merchandisers own the merchandising tools. The UX team own front-end tool, but there's no strategic vision of the product. And when you're looking at a new piece of technology, you've got to have a clear definition of what the product purpose is, what you want to own versus what you want to outsource. And I think that for me is where enterprise businesses don't always have the right skill.
I think that, I've got an example or like a really bad example of that from a client I worked on. I think it will take us nicely onto the next point. But the worst example I saw was essentially where different teams were making different decisions in isolation, and there was quite a high budget for the project. And they ended up, like, a number of teams were looking at, you know, the Magic Quadrant. There were multiple consultancies in, and they ended up selecting SAP Hybris as their econ platform. Then another team selected Sitecore for content management. And then they ended up picking various Adobe products as well alongside it. And I guess that's a good example of, on paper, dependent on your sources, you know, that could be considered best in class, but realistically you're kind of overpaying for solutions that kind of cross over and probably don't work amazingly well together.
That's a perfect example. And I've seen this in other places where people have picked a digital experience platform because it's strong on CMS, but it has other things around it. Obviously your DXP is different. It offers additional elements. So like might have search, merch, personalization. But then somebody else has picked a high-end search and merch personalization tool. So you've got, and these aren't modular licensing, not like some of the modern ones where you might be able to pick like the search bit, but not personalization bit. So they're paying high-end enterprise licenses for two platforms that cross over massively. And those are enterprise licenses negotiated with specific contract terms. You realize you're now locked in for a minimum of 18 months to 2 years, and you've just burned tens of thousands of pounds for no reason. Yeah, it's exactly. And that's why the product management bit. And I think when an enterprise organization is trying to think about migration and risk management, somebody has to perform the product management role in this process to align that thinking so that one person hasn't gone over and signed with a vendor that is not aligned with the overall stack. And I think the biggest question starts with what's driving the stack. Is the CMS driving it, or is the econ platform then driving all the other subsets? Like, there's no right or wrong to it, but you've got to make a decision of what the primary system is to then dictate the rest. So, but yeah, the comment you made links on really nicely about the looking at the Magic Quadrant. And I have had, there have been some really good discussions on LinkedIn about, you know, I think it was Tim Richardson had a question recently about, you know, should people be paying attention to like Gardner's Magic Quadrant, Forrester's Wave? What purpose do they serve? And our viewpoint is always, do you know what? It's good to see how other people are rating systems, but you have to take a pinch of salt. They're not the de facto sources where you get your info. Interestingly, some businesses, that's where they go, like, you know, investors or C-suite will go, well, look, Salesforce, Adobe, these guys at the top, that's what we should be looking at. So how do you, what do you think are the risks in that? And how do you avoid just people always, enterprise, always looking at the same three or four platforms?
Yeah, so I think like this and the next point end up being quite a broad discussion. I think, so this episode was triggered by me speaking to a business that I felt had approached a platform selection piece incorrectly. And essentially they were trying to do an apples for apples comparison across a number of platforms that can't really be compared. And I think the way that e-com's gone now, where you've got, you know, platforms that essentially won't cover any of the front end, you've got platforms like Shopify, where you're going to have a series of important third parties around it that, you know, need to be considered as part of an overall solution. And then you've got like a Salesforce that is kind of almost kind of like one solution trying to cover everything. And I think part, like with Gartner, I think some of that is covered, but a lot of it isn't as well. And I think that's where some of those solutions fall down. I also think that, I mean, I think it's overall like that, you know, I know someone that works at Gartner, and he was explaining to me that, you know, the researchers do speak to loads of people. I think it's just really hard to do a comparison like that with the amount of variables there are by vertical, retailer size, platform nuance. I just think it's too hard. So, and I think if we go back to that point on kind of like where we started this episode, I personally feel like nowadays, because I think in the mid-market, typically you see very little, you don't see as many like mistakes when it comes to the tech stack. And I think a lot of that is because people are connected, they're going out and speaking to other brands, they're looking at what their competition have done, like, and there's less major stakeholders, so like that one person or that small team are going away and doing due diligence, whereas I feel like that doesn't happen as much in the enterprise. But I think based on that one conversation that I had, which I think I felt like there was risk of, you know, almost like they could go and choose an SAP or, you know, an Adobe just by looking at, you know, features in isolation and stuff like that. I feel like you need, because I think bringing in consultants is one thing, but I just feel like nowadays you just got to put more time into like speaking to different groups of people and just getting more context around, you know, where things are going, roadmap, you know, how an ecosystem is developing, like the speed of change around the platform. You know, net new brands that are coming on board that fall within kind of where you want to be. And then also like how people are using it, how it can feasibly work as part of a stack that's relevant to you. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, it's quite a hard one to answer, but I just think you've got to put more time into getting understanding these days, just because it's not as simple as it used to be where you'd go for a monolith platform and use it for everything. I don't know if you agree with that.
Elastic Path is on a mission to break through the barriers that prevent commerce leaders from delivering extraordinary shopping experiences. Both business and tech teams are able to innovate on their own terms, fully embrace composability, and in turn, never compromise on what's possible. Learn more at www.elasticpath.com.
Yeah, increasingly I find the word monolith the misleading thing that I just think people should forget about. Because we've talked about something like Shopify's application is a monolith, but the ecosystem is very different in how it's architected to something like a Salesforce. And, you know, Salesforce is obviously trying to modernize by bringing its composable storefront and, you know, new connectors. But fundamentally, the difference is that it's been built out of a legacy stack with a huge amount of functionality native to the platform, but that takes a lot of modernizing, that takes a lot of effort to maintain and support. So I guess the question, I think the point you made earlier is the key one, is it's a mentality and a mindset shift, and sometimes there are preconceptions that if not everything is native to the platform, there is more risk, it's less secure. And at enterprise level, security is critical. Now, we did a project recently, didn't we, with a big fashion retailer in the enterprise space. And they have, obviously, somebody within the internal IT team who's focused on security. And that is a massive concern. And obviously it is, because at that scale, if you screw up your security and you have an issue with penetration, it can lead to a massive, not just brand damage, but income loss. So it is really important. But I think there's a misconception that having like a SaaS platform, for example, where you have lots of apps, is less secure, and therefore you're open to more risk. Yeah. Actually, the development standards enforced on app partners in order to have an app released into that ecosystem are incredibly high, because the SaaS platform, without its high uptime, and you know, Shopify had its recent 45-minute downtime, so that always gets people excited. But the SaaS platform's uptime is its revenue. If it's not stable and it's not secure, it's not going to win business. It's not going to keep business. So also in the amount of time and effort that goes into it, from the core application point of view, is huge. So I think it's more about trying to change the narrative in a big business to help them understand that what they're trying to achieve is the goal, not the architectural way it's done. Because if you start on, oh, everything's in the platform, that's what I want, you're not looking at business need, you're looking at outcome. And I think we've got it flipping the narrative sometimes, yeah, help people think about things differently. Because then if they go down that route of it, it's all based on business need and where they want to get and what's going to support them operationally. If they then decide, having evaluated a different model, that it isn't right, they've done it on merit, and that's fine. But if you exclude it, yeah, without understanding, then you are missing a trick.
Well, I think that's the thing as well. And I think if I look at how some businesses, I've seen some businesses approach this, it's kind of, you know, trying to capture native functionality and leaving it there. Whereas I think you've almost got to like build out, you know, a set of initial requirements and then work with the vendors initially to get a view of like how that functionality is going to be achieved and then which third party is going to be needed, and then start to assess like the security side, the TCO side, with how those are being built, etc. And then start to do your due diligence on the quality of those approaches. So I also think the other risk in all of this, particularly enterprise level, is it's so easy to demo something or say something and make it look amazing, whereas in actual fact, you know, there could be massive knock-on effects, or you know, it could be like ridiculously rigid. And I think that's the biggest thing. So thinking back to that project, I guess, like there was quite a lot of that where like you see something and you think that is absolutely perfect for what we need. But yeah, then the more you look into it, the more like it might restrict you in the future. So I think that's the hard thing, is like with these enterprise businesses, it's like, yeah, how do they get to that point? I think it probably is just a case of like you need to bring in very specialist consultants, and I think that's another whole episode in itself around specialist consultants versus consultancies. But yeah, I think you do just need like people, or not even necessarily, it could be contractors, but I think you just need people that have been in and around the area like to input and tell you where you need to do the extra due diligence.
Yeah, and one of the key narratives in Rick Watson's post, which definitely resonates, is that the risk and the potential cost and effort of change puts a lot of CEOs in enterprise space off, because it's, do you know what? It's working. It's not perfect, but it's working. Christ, it's going to take us so much time and effort. But I guess a key question that we should discuss is like that business case bit. Like, how do you, what is the business case for going through this effort? Because it does take time. When you're talking with big stakeholder sets and you've got complex legacy tech stacks that need serious evaluation, because when you're looking at a simple D2C fashion brand, okay, it's much simpler to do this is how we're going to use a platform like Shopify, BigCommerce, etc. When you've got all this like legacy stack code issues, technical debt, process debt, you're right, that point about the due diligence takes longer, because you start at the high level and then you peel it back and you get to the specialist areas and you have to do more and more due diligence when you realize things like omnichannel flows, when you've got store store stock and inventory, like multi-warehouse, you know, different rules around all this stuff. So let's talk about how you build the business case. So when somebody comes to you and they're like, oh, we just, you know, we're thinking that we're not going to bother, it's too much effort. How would you constructively challenge them to say, look, you really should do this, and here's why you should put the time and effort into doing the evaluation?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I guess usually when we do that, there'll be someone internally that's, you know, got some level of motivation to do this. But I think, I mean, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? Because I can think of so many brands that I have spoke to that have been on a very dated stack, and they're just kind of like, they've just kind of accepted the cost and the ways of working, and that they might not be as agile, and they've kind of written off medium term replatforming, even though, you know, they're 5 versions out of date on SAP, and, you know, things are taking ages, which is really interesting. But I think in terms of the business case, one, I guess, would be like long-term TCO. Two would be like, I guess, the benefits of specific best-in-class features and areas. Because usually with like the really dated or like real like legacy systems, you know, there'll be certain things around CRM that have just been, you know, pushed back on for years, or, you know, pulling data out of the platform that could be really valuable to the business, etc. So I guess it's like starting to quantify like the value of some of those areas, and then, you know, bundling it all together and putting a number on it. But yeah, I think for me, it's probably that. It's like incremental improvement in functionality that could drive revenue or customer experience. Another one could be if you're looking at doing something like an upgrade and a redesign, and suddenly the cost of replatforming ends up being similar or less, which that's probably been the biggest driver for us actually with most of the projects we've done. And then the other one would be cost saving, which I think is going to be very big for next year. So if you can prove a massive reduction in OpEx costs, and actually over a 5-year period, you might save a load of money, 3 to 5 year period, then I think that'll be the other one.
Yeah. For me, the cost of inaction is always an interesting one. So I once did a cost model with the head of e-commerce who was struggling to get traction with her director, because his view was, we're just, you know, we're going to spend loads of money and there's no guarantee it's going to improve things, like you say. And we just looked at all the processes that her team had to do on a daily and weekly basis that didn't need to be done, that could be automated, regardless of like, just with either a better version of the current one, as in a modern version, or a new modern tech stack. And I think we worked out something about $80,000 a year could be saved in the current team, from a team of 4, which is quite a lot because of the amount of even promotions. So to do a promotion, they had to set up a promotion in the admin tool. They then had to contact IT, because IT then had to code logic to apply the promotional discount in. And then that had to be released in staging. It had to be tested in staging. Then it had to be set up in live. And you're like, wow, Jesus, to set up a promotion? Are you kidding me? So I think that cost of inaction is brilliant. The opportunity cost, and that project we worked on recently, one of the ones we looked at, and one of the ones when the e-com team were pushing back to the in their like boards back, was about the inability to execute parts of the strategy to deliver on the growth plans because of the time cost and effort of releasing on one of those market leaders. And it was like to launch a new international store. They couldn't justify it, and they couldn't do it when they suddenly needed tactically to launch. They couldn't do it quick enough because it was like a 4-month turnaround rather than like a 2-week turnaround. And then the final one, which I think is really important, and it's quite hard to put a number on it, is team churn. So it's hard to maintain really motivated, sharp people who want to do great things if the tech is limiting them, and the tech is old and obsolete, and the tech doesn't do anything to their CV. There are a lot of good technology providers out here doing their best, but they're not they don't have a modern, vibrant system where loads of brands are going investing. And there are some platforms where people are moving away more than they're joining. Oh, and this front-end development's a great example. It's where people don't want to work on outdated tech. They want to be able to showcase on their CV that they're using Vue, React, pick your technology that a front-end developer wants to work on. So actually, not only do you risk losing good staff if the tech continues to be slow and behind the market and they're getting no satisfaction, but attracting the best, if you really want to grow and scale and be a market leader, you need market leading talent, and you can't acquire that talent easily if your tech stack is completely out of sync with their expectations. So I think that's really important. As I say, much harder to put a financial number on till I get a board, but it's definitely something worth thinking about.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. And I've actually seen that firsthand from around hiring, optimization people and even head of e-coms where, they just don't want to work in a business. It's got, where they're restricted by technology. And the other one that I was going to put in as well around the business case, often dependent on the platform you're on, a few of the ones we've worked on recently have been driven by security and compliance where they're on an end of life platform. And actually, that's a big part of the business case as well. I think all really good points.
And what else have you seen in terms of common blockers? Because one of the ones that I've often come across, and it's a hard one to unpick, is in bigger businesses, we all know that us humans, we're fickle characters, in some way that technology is prone to breaking. But with bigger teams, with bigger senior leadership teams, inevitably comes more politics. More silos, and you often get individuals who have a bias to a particular tech, and maybe they put it in, maybe they've only ever worked on that, or maybe they've got a relationship with a supplier and they want to own that and they don't want that to change. And if you get that isolation where people have different viewpoints and people feel like they should own and then become a blocker, that's one of the key ones that I found, which is a real challenge in dealing with. And you invariably don't get that at SME level. I've not seen it for quite a while, actually, at that level. You might have a few disagreements, but I've never seen that level of blocking. What have you seen? How do people overcome that so it doesn't derail a project and stop people evaluating on merit?
Yeah, so I think definitely have seen that. I think often that's where you bring consultants in. So I once got bought into a project and was kind of tricked, actually. So there was one particular stakeholder who was very pro a technology, which I was not informed of. And then essentially, without knowing what was happening, I guess I was brought in to build a case against that platform and for another platform. And it ended up being quite hostile. And this person had, a massive background in this technology, was on one of their advisory boards, etc. But I think, their actual reasonings for bringing me in was right. It was more the way that it was dealt with that probably could have been a bit better. Yes. And maybe it could have been managed a bit better. I would have communicated slightly differently for sure. I think that's one thing, bringing in consultants. Another one would, I guess, just be putting time into building a case another way. And another one that I would say the biggest blocker I see by a long way, and I don't know if you agree with this, is people seeing replatforming as a risk to BAU. So regardless of how much it's needed, how much people want to, senior stakeholders just seeing it as too big a distraction. And I think that's an interesting one because I've also ended up building quite a lot of cases in the past around how you avoid the distraction. I know you've done a lot of that as well. And I think nowadays, you can outsource such big parts of projects and you can bring in, if you bring in the right team, you're always going to need key internal team members involved in projects, but I don't think it needs to be as bad as it maybe used to be a few years ago.
Yeah, I agree. And I think the key thing is when you have a large business with lots of stakeholders and therefore lots of different parts and normally more legacy tech challenges, is you need a proper project team and a PMO function. And that needs, for big ones, you often need a program manager and maybe a couple of project managers. And you'll need BAs because the process mapping piece needs to be done properly before you can't evaluate tech if you don't understand your process. It's really hard because someone will go, this is how you do it. You go, okay, how does that fit with our operation model? So that bit's really important. And I think you can bring in externals for a lot of that, but you're right. You fundamentally, the decision makers need to be the business, because the business has to have ownership. Consultants can guide and advise and help them make better decisions and point out things of, hey, you do it like this at the moment, other people do it like that. You sure your process shouldn't be changing here? But fundamentally, if a business isn't owning the decision gates as you go through, then they don't really have the same investment and stake in the project. And it's much harder to get people to buy into change when they don't own that and don't feel like they are the ones who have guided that change. I think that's good. I think the balance of external and internal is a real challenge. And that means spending the time up front. And I think the bit that external people need to help enterprise businesses with better is explain to them the justification for the investment, because the PMO function costs. It's a chunk of money. It's seen as a cost, not a benefit. So you have to be able to flip that and explain that as a benefit and talk about how that's going to protect BAU. Because, you know, if somebody's distracted 25% off of peak trading, that you could put money on that and go, well, you're not going to be as efficient in your trading campaigns. That could be a loss. So therefore, we can protect that amount of it. So revenue protection is one bit. But also, I think it's the impact of making the right technology decision as well. Because as you said before, like if you get the wrong tech stack, cost will be huge. You'll end up spending a license in your day, obviously. But yeah, it's often a conversation that doesn't happen is when I see like proposals, is like, what's the cost for doing this rather than what's the benefit? And I think the more people, going away from costs, right? You've got to pay the money. You can't bring in external expertise without cash. But fundamentally, somebody's got to be talking to the person who signs all this off about why and what impact it's going to have positively for them and their business.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Yeah, and I think actually, I guess it's probably slightly different in the enterprise as well, where there's obviously bigger gaps to fill. I think all that makes sense.
So let's pause on this one, because I know that, I mean, this is such a big topic. We could carry on chatting for ages and it'll probably send everybody to sleep. So for those of you who haven't fallen asleep and have enjoyed that, we'd love you to like reach out to us on our LinkedIn post. Tell us what do you think? How do you think enterprise businesses should approach technology evaluation? If you're working in an enterprise business now, what are the blockers you see? What are the challenges you've got there? What have you learned about how you engage people in these projects and get stakeholders brought in so that you make better decisions for the business? We'd love to hear, because no one's got the right answer on this, right? It is a challenging thing to do. But thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed it. Keep your ear open for the next episode. And remember to give us that rating before you go. Thanks very much, everybody. For more information on this topic, head over to replatform.fm for our audio podcasts. To discuss a project, or if you'd like to chat about any of the topics covered in this episode in more detail, please reach out to myself, James Gerd, or my co-host, Paul Rogers, via LinkedIn and Twitter. Thanks again for listening, and keep your ears peeled for the next episode.